League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Welcome to the Dear Love Joy podcast, and it's another special. Today's guest is Dr. Julia Shaw, the first returning guest we've ever had on this podcast. Fina's here today. How are you, Fina?
I'm very good, Tim. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm excited about meeting Dr. Julia Shaw in a minute. She did the memory illusion, and she educated me on how my memory is bad, but how everyone's memory is bad. And we don't remember a lot of things. She educates the police about how when you take a statement off a witness, it invariably, well, there could be a lot of mistakes in it. I'll talk to her a bit, I'll get her to explain it again in a minute. A lot of what we remember, we think we remember, we haven't actually remembered correctly. So it's fascinating. And she's actually done, which is intriguing at the moment with a lot of the Me Too stuff. Mm. Because obviously people are trying to remember things from sometimes decades ago. She's actually been clever because she's got involved in a an app called Talk to Spot, which is a tool to report workplace harassment and discrimination. And you don't have to talk to a human, you talk to our app, which is AI, and it talks to you. So sounds pretty good idea, right?
That is awesome.
Right, so let's find out all about that. And I'm obviously going to ask her some other questions about the memory because it intrigues me as well. So let's meet her. Dr. Julia Shaw.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into dear love joy.
Dr. Julia, thank you very much for coming again to my kitchen. You're my first returning guest.
Ooh.
How exciting is that? And I've got you a present.
Oh.
I've got you two presents. I bought you that, which is wine.
I'll take it.
That's nice.
Got it.
That's nice.
What is it? It's red, wrapped up.
Do you like wine?
I do like wine.
Oh, do you know about wine?
I do know about wine.
Oh, tell me what you think of that then, because it's...
I don't know enough about wine to know what it is. Tell me about it.
Oh, well, I don't know enough. I just go to the man in the shop and I say, get me a nice bottle of wine.
It looks like a nice bottle of wine.
And everybody always says they like it. And I've also got you this... I'm kind of re-gifting this, but I think it's a good book for you. I interviewed Harriet Harman not so long ago on this podcast, and she's got this book, A Woman's Work. And I think you're really going to enjoy that because of what we're going to talk about, Talk to Spot, in a minute. It's kind of the history of the women's movement, and she was such a big player in it. There's obviously some anti-Tory stuff in there because she's a Labour MP and all that sort of stuff. But at the beginning of the book's really interesting from the 70s.
I love how that was a disclaimer.
Well, I'm just being honest with you. But at the beginning,
academic, I'm not a Tory.
But at the beginning,
those don't work very well together somehow.
You're not a Tory.
No.
Well, but it's really interesting because of you, the field you're working in, and I know how you are obviously very pro. The women's movement and everything. I think you're really going to enjoy that because it's the history from our country, how it all works. So give it a read and let me know.
Thank you.
Also on the wine, can you explain to me why when we drink our memories, we can't remember, that's the word I'm looking for.
Remember.
We can't remember anything.
Usually we can remember things. It's just sometimes when we drink too much that we don't remember.
What happens?
Your brain actually stops being able to form memories. So you essentially you've overloaded your brain with alcohol that it stops being able to physically form long-term memories. And so your blackout is like you can't ever get that back. So friends will like tell you stories and go, oh, remember this. And you go, maybe you could feel like you can start to remember, but you won't. You can't.
What about when you're you're when you first wake up and you can't remember a lot, then it slowly starts coming back during the day. What's happening there?
So that's called a gray out normally, where it's sort of because of a combination of being really tired and being really groggy. You might struggle to first remember stuff, but that at that point you weren't so drunk that you couldn't create memories. It's just that there's all the other physical symptoms the next morning that make it really difficult to focus on getting the right memories back.
And do drugs work in the same way as alcohol?
Depending on the drug. So there's a category of drugs called benzodiazepines, which are the kinds of drugs that are also associated with like roofies. So kind of date rape drugs,
yeah.
The naughty, the bad side, but also are sometimes taken recreationally, which still sort of confuses me.
Yeah. I don't get that either. There's sort of people flopping around like fish, sort of like in nightclubs, not really being able to remember anything or do anything. What's the point?
Why do you want this?
Yeah.
But in hospitals, so like in hospitals, you get them sometimes. Actually, doctors will sometimes intentionally give people for really invasive and really painful procedures a category of benzodiazepines, which are both sedatives and block memory formation, which means that when you wake up, you don't have a terrifying, sort of traumatizing memory of what happened, which is really good because otherwise lots of people wouldn't do really important procedures that save their lives.
Yeah, apparently the roofie thing's bad at the moment, as in they're becoming more popular. It's a bad thing going out there. I mean, I'm old, so I'm not out in all the nightclubs and things, but apparently it's becoming quite a big thing. And
sounds a bit like news fear-mongering. I haven't heard of that being substantiated. That sounds a bit like people worried about people going clubbing, which I don't know. I feel like our generation is certainly quite aware of drink practices. It doesn't mean that we do it well, but I think, I don't know. I'm always hesitant to accept sort of, because we just don't know. We don't know how many roofies are going around.
What about weed? Because that seems to be coming out of prohibition now. In America, obviously it's Colorado and
coming
California.
Out of prohibition. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And so I don't know what's happening in Canada. Do you know if they legalized it over there yet?
Well, it's decriminalized, so you can get medical marijuana. I was actually recently in San Francisco. I was there a week after it became legalized.
Yeah.
And I went into a head shop for the first time. I just walked in. It was actually easier to buy weed than it was to buy alcohol, which I just wanted to do it because I was just there.
Yeah.
This is awesome. There's all these really branded products that you can get, like Rihanna branded weed, and you can get cookies. It's really bizarre. But in terms of how that affects your memory, that has a more long-term effect. So if you smoke a lot of weed over a long period of time, especially at certain critical ages, like when you're a teenager, it can change the way your brain forms long-term memories, and it makes it more difficult to some extent to have those lasting connections. So that's a more cumulative effect. So the more weed you smoke, there can be damage, but if you're a recreational user, it's not really going to do anything.
Is that for cigarettes as well, nicotine, or just weed?
I don't know of any correlation between nicotine and memory, but I'm also, just to be clear, I'm also not a psychophysiologist, so this isn't exactly my area. I'm much more applied memory scientist.
Yeah, because I worry about the strength of the stuff now. It's like they're all smoking skunk. And
again, you and your fear-mongering, everything's getting worse. All the drugs are getting stronger.
Isn't that
chill
the case?
Out, Tim.
Isn't that the case, though? That is just really strong.
Isn't that just what everybody thinks about?
Maybe.
In my day.
Maybe. I don't know enough about it, but it just seems to me that it's definitely going to change the world a bit, isn't it? Because we are coming out, as I say, of prohibition for marijuana, so and weed and everything else, and so it's going to be one of those things that a lot of people are going to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's generally an evidence-based move, so I think that people will always smoke weed, and ultimately controlling it and regulating it and taxing it is probably the way forward.
Yeah. So as I said, you are the first returning guest. There's a reason for that, which we'll discuss in a minute, but remind us what you actually do.
So I'm a memory scientist and I work at UCL. And recently I co-founded a startup that deals with helping people remember and reliably record harassment and discrimination at work so that we can help fix the underreporting issue.
Okay, we'll get onto that in a minute, but so we can get some background to why that's important. You've had quite an impact on me. I just discussed it as you walked through my front door. Now, because you've told me that my memory is poor and everybody else's memory is poor, every time somebody says something and they go, yeah, I remember that, I'm just sitting there going, yeah, bullshit, you can't remember anything. Dr. Julia Shaw taught me you cannot remember anything. We can't remember a lot, can we?
Oh, I'm an awful person if I've made you feel that way. So last time I was on the show, I was here to talk about my book, The Memory Illusion, which is all about how we misremember things all the time. We think our memories are really good, but really they're quite faulty. And so there, I think I convinced you of this because I was talking about all the different ways in which our brains make stuff up and convince us that we experienced something when we were 1 year old and we sort of met grandma, when that's actually impossible, for example.
Yeah. And you're teaching the police about eyewitnesses, their accounts might not be true or might not be as real as they think they are.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's more about making sure that... So, yeah, I work with military, I work with the police. I work with different kinds of people who... And lawyers, so on legal cases. And I look at the quality of evidence. So there the question is this memory evidence high quality? Like, is it reliable? And it's not so much about trying to figure out whether people are lying. It's about just is it high quality memory? And for police, the bigger question is also, how do we make sure that police are asking the right questions? And my research shows that it's really easy to ask the wrong questions. And the questioning process itself can taint and dramatically alter your memory. So we need to be really, really careful to train police to ask neutral and open questions.
Our reality is not reality.
We live in our own reality. Reality is purely subjective. I mean, even from your perception to how you remember your own life, to the memories you bring into the situation and how you interpret things is completely your own. And we think we share a reality. We think we share this moment sitting here in your kitchen.
Yeah.
But what I'm experiencing is probably very different from what you're experiencing, even though we feel like we're experiencing the same thing.
And we do, yeah. It's, I've spent a lot of time thinking about it.
I can see your mind still being blown over there.
It does, yeah. Well, no, you have changed it. It's you're one of my favorite guests. I quote you all the time on here because it is so integral in my reality that I have to have a memory of the past and I don't, which you've taught me. And now I look at everything in a slightly different way. As I say, you've had quite an impact on me. You also taught me that I can put memories in other people's heads, which I don't think you thought I was going to use it the way I did.
No, I didn't think I'd be giving you a new evil superpower.
So basically, I was just telling the story before we started recording that a friend of mine, we went for a coffee and I said to her, I was discussing it and she was sort of saying, I'm not sure that's true. And I said, well, look, I kept on saying to her, do you remember the first time we met in this coffee place and I was dressed as a clown? And I keep saying that to her every time
pretty
I see her.
Specific as well.
Well, I thought I'd
memorable
go,
thing.
I thought I'd go
big.
Quite extreme. And now when she texts me, she sometimes says emojis a clown. So it's clearly going in there. And I can see myself in the clown outfit in the coffee shop. That's the weird thing.
So you've got your own false memory.
Yeah, I'm creating my own false memory. But that's sort of what people do, isn't it? You've done experiments like that, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I mean, in mine, I also do it extreme. So I convince people that they committed crimes that never happened. So I get people to falsely confess with vivid detail to stuff that didn't happen, like assaulting someone with police contact or attacking someone with a weapon or like with a rock, not a gun, or stealing something. And I mean that it is shocking how easy it is to convince people with a little bit of mixture of trust, of imagination, and essentially just a manipulation that they've done these things. And so we need to be very, very careful to take precautionary steps. I mean, with friends, convincing them that you're in a clown outfit might not be a life or death memory. But when we're talking about important emotional events, details matter, and it's important to make sure.
Remind us why we can't remember everything.
Well, for one, your brain, I mean, even if you close your eyes and try to describe, I mean, this is your own kitchen. And I think you'd struggle if you closed your eyes to describe exactly where everything is in your own kitchen.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
And that's something you see every day and something that you're currently in and that your memory is never going to get better than that. Mm. And yet you still struggle. So, I mean, from the very beginning, we're not taking in everything. We're not paying attention to everything that's around us. Never mind laying it down as a foundation for later. And then mix that with some social influence, telling the story a few times. Stories get better maybe every time you tell them. The clown gets more and more vivid, more and more extreme. By the end, you've got a potentially totally different version, so, or you've forgotten it.
So when I say I've got a bad memory, which I often say to people, that means I'm basically the guy who's telling the truth. Whereas when everyone else says that, oh, and I've got a great memory, that means they're the liars. And I'm a good guy and they're the bad people.
They're not the liars. We all think we're good at our own, I don't know. We often think we're the best person in the room at lots of things. I mean, you're obviously the best driver on the road because all the other people
are. See, I don't think that either.
You don't think that?
No, because I've been surrounded by men who always bang on about how brilliant they are at driving.
Yeah,
I remember thinking years ago, come on, we can't all be good at driving.
You can't all be better than average.
Yeah, this is ridiculous.
That's not how average
yeah.
does work.
It's a man thing, you know? It's like, oh yeah, I'm brilliant at driving and I eat really hot food, you know?
Well, yeah, right.
Oh. And I drink more than anyone else.
Oh, all there's those... a word for that. Do you want a new word? You might know this word. Toxic masculinity.
Is that what it's called?
That's what
it's like
called.
That.
It's when you do detrimental things to yourself or to encourage other people to do risky behaviors because it's, quote, masculine.
So I've always rejected it all and I've always gone, no, you're a better drinker than me. I'm a rubbish drinker. And I've always made up laws and rules why I don't have to drink as much as every other man because I'm not that good at it. So that's
an easy out.
Yeah, it is. And I can't be bothered to get involved in the driving games and everything else. I'm just not that interested in it really.
Yeah. But in terms of memory, I mean, whether you're a man or a woman, I mean, a lot of, we only know our own memories and we generally assume that we're pretty good at stuff. Just like we all think we're above average in intelligence and attractiveness. Like we pretty much think we're above average in most things. Yeah. Most of us, maybe not you, Tim.
So, well, but some of them, some things.
There's an introspection there and a sort of a realization that you're not necessarily being more honest, but you maybe understand more about how faulty your memory is if you're saying, I have a bad memory. Rather than someone who overestimates their capacity and says, you know, my memory's amazing.
Yeah, in fairness, I was sitting with two guys the other day and they were having a conversation and they were talking about false memories. And I thought, this is really interesting. They were saying how a lot of the stuff they remember.
False memories, of course, are memories of things that never happened.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know that. I'm just saying that.
Yeah, they were talking.
The listeners don't know this.
But they were talking about poor memories as well. And they were talking about all sorts of different things. And I thought, it's really interesting how buzzy it's become discussing memory. Do you think that's to do with you, the impact you've had at the moment?
I mean, that would be taking a lot of credit. I think there's a movement right now. There's a bit of a Zeitgeist, as you'd say in German. There's sort of a spirit of the times that people are maybe realizing that their brains are faulty and that there's lots of stuff that we're not as good at.
Yeah.
Memory being one of those things. I mean, I think I really wanted to, with the memory illusion, I really wanted to start a conversation about false memory. I really wanted to make it accessible. And I've seen a tremendous increase in the amount of people talking about false memories and using the correct terms. And that's wonderful. But I obviously have no idea if that's because of me or me
well,
and
just,
lots of other people.
Yeah, but just remind people, how many different languages has your book been translated into now?
I think now it's 60 and 70. We recently sold Arabic. It's coming out in Norway in a couple of weeks. It's still coming out in different countries.
It's incredible. Are you having to go on a PR tour around to these places? Or
I go to some of them. So I recently I did a video for Poland. So some of the places I don't go in person because I also don't speak the language. So it makes it more difficult. But in places like Norway, they speak English. So
yeah.
You can just rock up and do interviews in English. But yeah, I mean, I'm also, it's really fun. I like talking about memory. I like trying to communicate sort of complex and scientific concepts to people so they're actually useful and they can apply them in their everyday lives.
And do you enjoy doing all the media stuff? You came on Sunday Brunch, my TV show. Did you enjoy doing that?
I did. And you asked nice questions, although you were critiqued for it, I saw.
I did what?
You were criticized for your boring questions.
Was I?
You were.
By whom?
Someone
on Twitter.
Some press outlet. No, there was an actual article written about how
really?
Boring your questions were.
Oh,
I feel
God.
Like you, because you and I had talked so much about this, you're like, oh, I know lots of these things.
Oh, dear.
But it was still really fun to be able to talk about the book.
I always wonder if it's frustrating. By the way, I get criticized for everything I say on that show. But that's, you know what? That's a good thing. Because
problem with being famous.
Well, it means people are watching and that's nice. Our ratings are at the moment going up quite well. So we're enjoying that. But I wonder if it's frustrating for you because you do an interview with me on this podcast, it's an hour long or something. And then you go onto a show like Sunday Brunch, we give you 7 minutes and you've got to get everything across. Is it frustrating or is it?
I mean, I think that I teach entire university lecture series on the same issues as I do in a 10-minute TED talk. So, I mean, I think that I understand that different amounts of time just warrant different amounts of information that I can share. And it's trying to distill sort of the most important or the most meaningful stuff for that particular segment. I don't think it's necessarily better or worse. I think it's important to be able to succinctly summarize what you have to say. But I think it's also great for people to have access to the longer version so they can get all the details.
Yeah. How is the impact of doing something like Sunday Brunch? Do you get a lot of people talk to you?
I would love to come back if you ever have me again.
I don't make the decisions. I did recommend you.
You did. I did, and you did get me on eventually.
I did, yeah, because I knew people would be interested in it. You've got a new book coming out. It's called Evil, The Science Behind Humanity's Dark Side. What's that about them?
Evil, well, it's not coming out till next year. But Evil is, it's going to be about understanding why we all do and think bad things. So it's supposed to be sort of an introspective book. And it's essentially questions like, what's the difference between me and a murderer? And maybe realizing that that line is a lot more gray than we often like to think it is. And what could push you over the edge?
Yeah, see, this is an interesting subject, isn't it? Because do we have free will or are we machines? And if we're machines, then we've just sort of been programmed really to kill somehow.
That's a very dark. So this isn't a science fiction book. It is, in fact, a nonfiction book. it's not so much like man versus machine or automaton versus thinking.
What I'm saying
introspective
is,
creature.
Is you take two children, okay, not twins.
Go on.
You put one, you take them from
birth. You randomly assign them to a happy family.
Yeah, you put one in a really happy family. You put one who's being beaten and who's mm-hmm. getting very bad treatment mm-hmm. all their lives. Which one is going to end up being the one who creates havoc and maybe ends up in prison or maybe turns into something?
Could be either. Could be either. I mean, one's more likely depending on what exactly in their upbringing they've experienced.
Yeah. So, you don't think there would be a correlation?
There is a correlation for sure. But I think that we also, we like to oversell those influences because I mean there are just so many reasons why people do bad things.
Yeah,
I mean we're all hypocrites. We all do things that we ourselves think are bad or evil, and yet we do them anyway. Like I think that fundamentally we probably shouldn't eat meat, and so my solution to that is like a vegan day a week. Like whoop-de freaking do.
Why shouldn't we eat meat?
Well, because I mean between animal torture, between the impact on the planet, between like it's a really bad thing for our health and the health of the planet, and yet like. But it's tasty. So I mean, and that's just like a very
nature,
basic level.
And something, the problem is for you to live, something's got to die. And that's the reality of it, whether it be a plant or an animal,
yeah.
Something has to die for you to live. And we've tried to move ourselves so far away from that reality. And I think it's quite a strange place we've got ourselves into where we're trying to remove ourselves from nature. Every animal out there is either trying to eat something or not be eaten itself, aren't they?
But we're more able to make conscious decisions about how we impact the planet and ourselves. And I think that, yeah, I mean, and it's the same thing with things like infidelity. Like most people say infidelity or cheating on our partners is the worst thing ever. And yet many of us cheat on our partners. I mean, again, and somehow we justify it, and sometimes how we found the context and we keep it secrets. But like we do lots of things that we fundamentally disagree with, and yet we continue to do them. So my question is, what does science say about that, and why?
Yeah.
Why am I doing these things anyway? And how many other people are doing these things? And at what point does it become really problematic?
The thing about evil, though, I'm quite intrigued by it, because I've listened to a few podcasts on this sort of stuff, and what intrigues me is we're getting more and more lenient with people. We used to sort of we used to hang, draw and call to people and pay to watch it.
Uh-huh.
And then we used to just kill people, right?
We still kill. I mean, we don't in
we
the UK,
don't no
but some,
and then people
some
used to pay
do.
To see it, and then they said, well, look, we'll kill people, but you can't watch it anymore,
right?
And now a lot of the world has gone, you know, look, we're not going
to
kill
probably
anyone
not
anymore.
Cool to kill
we're
people.
Gonna put people in prison instead, right. And that's it. And so we're sort of trying to go, let's rehabilitate people instead mm-hmm. of trying to just lock them away. So we're moving in that direction all the time where we think it might not just be their fault. It might be society's fault or our fault as well, aren't we? We're moving that direction.
Well, and they're just human beings. I mean, if you do something wrong, I like to do this thought experiment where think about the worst thing you've ever done. Now think about that being what defines you. And what everybody knows about you, like A, is that representative? Probably not. B, is that something that you think is fair? And then C, do you think you should lose your job? And do you think you should go to prison or be killed because of it?
Yeah, we like revenge, don't we?
We like revenge, but it's not a solution. People are going to act out of line forever. And B, it's just people are humans and we need to remember their humanity.
There's an interesting case, and I'm just going to talk nonsense here because I don't know any of the facts, but there's an interesting case where a guy killed someone, but he was on drugs and they decided that the drugs...
Very specific.
Yeah, the drugs were the cause.
that happened.
Do you know what? You'll like this. They decided that the drugs were the cause of him killing this person. So say the sentence was 20 years. They decided mm-hmm. the best way of doing it was just to halve the sentence. Mm-hmm. And he was fine with that. All the people were fine with it. It's ridiculous. You either did it or you didn't do it. But they thought the only way to deal with this, to make everything right, was just half the sentence. But if he was not responsible because he was on drugs, why not just let him out?
But I mean, as much as you're right that legally we have guilty or not guilty, I mean, that isn't how simple it often is. Like, you can be a bit responsible. Like, you can have made intentionally bad decisions that have led to a circumstance, but maybe it got out of hand. So you are a bit responsible,
yeah.
But you're not maybe as responsible as the ultimate outcome.
Only if you believe in free will, which leads me on to Charles Whitman in 1966. This is the thing which really intrigued me. The guy who, do you know about this guy? He murdered his mother and his wife, and then I think he killed 14 other people. But he in his suicide note, he wrote saying, "I've got problems in my head. Please examine me. I don't think I'm feeling right." And when mm-hmm. they open up his head, I think he had a brain tumor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had a brain tumor pressing against regions of his brain. And they think that is responsible for his strong emotions. So then you wonder if he's guilty at all because he's got a brain tumor. And that's where we get into this problem of, are you evil or not, I suppose, with things like that, do you?
Well, I fundamentally reject the concept of evil. I don't think there's such a thing as good or evil.
You've written a book about it.
I have written a book about it. Well, I've written a book about taking it apart. And essentially, my book is like, what about the nuance? It's like, I'm just like shouting, like, everybody remember the nuance. But yeah, I mean, in terms of whether someone's good or bad, I mean, I think that's not a useful way of classifying people. Whether my brain made me do it, sort of the legal defense question, that's a whole nother can of worms. And I think sometimes, I mean, everybody has a unique brain, and you could always argue that your brain made you do it for whatever reason, whether it's a brain tumor or not. But at what point does that become a useful defense?
Yeah, because how much of you is conscious and how much of you is subconscious? And that's
so many questions.
But your memory, all subconscious? Is it? And then you dig it out to get it into the conscious. How does it work? I'm looking at you desperately going, I don't understand my own head. How does it work? Is my memory subconscious and then I pull it into my conscious and that's how I remember
not really.
Things?
No. So, I mean, I don't think about things that way. I mean, I think that the way that we sometimes think about sort of the conscious and the subconscious is a very Freudian, so like Sigmund Freud, way of thinking about it, where we have sort of this hidden space that maybe also our brain is protecting us from, these repressed memories, damaging memories. And then there's the conscious brain that we have access to. I don't think that's a helpful way of looking at the brain. I also don't think that's necessarily true. But I do think that there are certainly things that are active now that you have access to easily because you've thought about them recently or because they're just, you know where that memory is, you know that that's a memory you have. And there are other things that pop out of nowhere. So you see or feel something and suddenly you're reminded of. I mean, this is classic also context reinstatement, is if you experience something when you're like, let's say something embarrassing.
Yeah.
The next time you're embarrassed about something, all these other embarrassing moments come up and you're like, fuck you, brain. Yeah. Like, I'm already feeling bad. Why are you bringing up all these other awful moments? And it's because you're in that emotional state. So it's easier to access similar kinds of memories.
I had and when you're watching stuff, people talk about things, it brings back memories of you going through that as well, doesn't it?
It can, yeah, for sure. For sure.
I was listening to another podcast the other day where the guy was talking about the memory, actually. And he said that we make our memories of traumatic events, we often make them worse. And maybe it's a survival technique. So if you've nearly been in the tsunami or you were in the tsunami mm-hmm. and you make your version of it a lot worse, if you've been in a terrorist attack, you kind of make it worse. And they were saying that they did done some studies. Sorry, I've just put this on you because mm-hmm. I just thought about it, so I don't know if you know, but apparently some of the survivors of 9/11, their stories became much more exaggerated, but not a bad thing. It's apparently a survival technique that we make it really bad for survival. Is there truth in that, you know?
I mean, I think classifying things as survival or not is not often not very useful, because also we don't really know exactly what helped in an ancestral environment to help, you know, our original humans survive. But in terms of trauma, I mean, definitely experiencing something negative and emotional. For one, there are big individual differences. People who work with PTSD, they only see the people who are really struggling to get over something. And certainly you can make things worse and it can be sort of become overwhelming and all consuming. But there's also about a third of people who have positive, who look at it as, oh my God, I survived that. How amazing.
Yeah.
And now I'm stronger for it because, you know, essentially the angels, you know, smiled and saved me. And this is a sign and now I know who my friends are, or now I know who's important to me. Mm. So it's like a second chance. And then a third of people seem to also just say, yeah, you know, it's an event. It happened. It was emotional, but I'm just going to keep living my life. So I think trauma also really has very different ways of affecting people that we sometimes underestimate. And humans can be very good at coping.
Mm.
But anyway, we're also here to talk about something else, aren't we?
Yep. Well, I'm just getting onto that now. Because it starts with me too, does it? How it started with
before
you?
Before me too.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Well, the idea was, not the release.
Okay.
So it was also before Weinstein. It was before a lot of the big allegations came out. But July 4th weekend, I met my co-founders, and it was amidst some of the media, the press around sexual harassment in the workplace, that we came up with the idea of combining my memory science, my research on what's called the cognitive interview, on how to interview people properly and make sure that they reliably recount what happened, and combining that with artificial intelligence and creating something to help people speak up about harassment and discrimination by helping them report it. And so giving the Me Too movement and those kinds of spaces, giving them a voice.
So when the Me Too movement came along, it was just like perfect storm for you. You were like, this is fantastic because it's what we believe in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had no idea last summer that people would still be talking about it the way they are now. I mean, it's just continued and amplified. And we're seeing issues around harassment and discrimination pop up in different industries. So, you know, we moved from things like big corporate entities that I'm not going to name involving cars, for example.
You know, this is why I've given you the book, Harriet Harman's book, A Woman's Work, because it's, I mean, I kept saying to her and she didn't really acknowledge it, but I've got a really lovely feeling that we're on the final push on this. And I think if you look back at what was going on in the 70s in this country, it was quite horrific the way women were treated, especially in the workplace.
Mm.
And I think we've got to the stage where we're getting there, and we just need, I think that's why the Me Too's hung around, because I think people are going, this is ridiculous. I mean, if you read that book, when she was going for a job as a solicitor, they would say things like, no, we've already got one. As we've already got one woman. But this is in the 70s and the 80s. This is ridiculous that was happening. I mean, but it was so commonplace. And I think we think it's ridiculous that there's harassment in the workplace, but we know it's happening. And
you say we know. I think
Hollywood knew it was happening.
I think there is still a lot of denial. So
do you think?
Given that I'm now right in the middle of the space and I talk to a lot of people about this issue, I think what I've come to learn is that we live in different realities, is that people who tick the boxes of what are called protected characteristics, so like being a woman, being a parent, being maybe a person of a visible minority, so being a person of color, or being someone who's like displays as Muslim, or even actually the worst affected community to some extent are people who are openly out, so the LGBTQI community. Statistically, I mean, their harassment levels are insane. But in terms of all this, I think that people who are in those spaces and work, which is most people, they know that this happens because it's partly happening to them and their friends. People who don't have that, and I mean, the classic sort of white male, maybe even in a position of power, doesn't have that reality. And so it can be very difficult to accept that that's happening at all, because I'm not experiencing or seeing it. So maybe women are just overreacting. Maybe people are just overreacting. And so it can be very difficult to convince people. And I think with the Me Too movement, there's awareness around the fact that this is happening in lots of different spaces. But I think we're very far from that actually being accepted. And I think we're very far from that being accepted as in my company. So when we at Spot started talking to companies about what we were doing, what we found is that everybody said, yeah, there's a problem with workplace harassment and discrimination. Yeah, Silicon Valley and these kinds of spaces have an issue, but our culture is amazing. We've got great work ethic here. I started using the phrase that harassment is something that other people do. And it's that lack of insight because you're not hearing about it at your own company and you're maybe not directly affected. And so you assume it's not happening here.
So what sort of form does harassment take?
So I'm interested in all kinds of harassment and discrimination, not just in sexual. I think Me Too is a great starting point and sort of times up for sexual harassment and really bringing that to light because it affects, half of the population. Half of the population by default is female. So that's a huge amount of people. But if we broaden that conversation, we realize that most of us can at some point in our lives be targets of harassment, whether it's or discrimination. So maybe at some point you'll be seen as too old for a job. Maybe at some point you're seen as you're a dad and you're somehow disadvantaged because you need more flexible working hours. There's lots of different reasons why we might be targets ourselves. And I forgot the question.
How many different forms of harassment are there? What form does it take? Because you said sexual and then obviously the other ones you're going through examples.
It can take all kinds of forms, but essentially, ultimately, it's about inappropriate workplace behavior that makes you feel like that. So harassment also, people often say, well, what if someone's overinterpreted a behavior? So you've made a comment to someone and maybe it's seen as racist. Now, whether you said it to that person or a witness says that was really inappropriate and it has negatively affected me emotionally, that can count as harassment. So even if you didn't mean it that way, the fact that you said it out loud, it's just like because you punched someone in the face and you didn't mean it violently, if the person has said, oh my God, like you just punched me in the face, obviously that's still a crime.
Yeah.
So you don't need the intent the way that sometimes people think of it. What really matters is the impact it has on others. And so if you're creating an environment that makes people feel like you have a toxic workplace, like they're being targeted because of something, because of who they are or because of someone else, who someone else is, that can be harassment.
Is the person who's doing it, who doesn't know they're doing it, though, is that you need to get to them to educate them?
Yeah, and I don't blame. We're right now, there's also a culture of calling people out. Like we're pretending that this is isolated people, isolated men in particular with regard to sexual harassment, that you can point at someone and say, that's the guy, that's the problem. Mm. Weinstein isn't the problem. He's part of the problem. He's someone who should be punished for what's happened and that it's good that that's come out. But Weinstein isn't the problem. The problem is a systemic culture that lets that happen for so long without anybody speaking up and that facilitates and creates that kind of human being. Men aren't born in isolation. Human beings aren't born in isolation. We are raised by the culture that we live in.
So is it a man thing or a power thing? Because men are doing it on men as well, aren't they? For the gay community. And is it giving someone power?
Power certainly can be a toxic thing that you introduce to a space because those people are less likely to speak up if they feel like they might lose their job because, say, their boss is harassing them. But it's also not a men versus women issue. So this is also, I would like us to move away both from singling out people and realizing, no, we're all part of this. We all have a role to play in making sure that we educate each other and understand what harassment and discrimination are and that we speak up when it happens.
The thing I've learned, I think, in my years and bizarrely, my age is something that I think about often in my job because you want young people on telly, don't you really? And But I accept it. I've got a shelf life because that's who I am. That's the sort of nature of the job I work in. But in my older years, I realized humans aren't very good with power. And I think, I believe this in politics and I believe it in a lot of things that it's not a good thing to let an individual have power. You should reward people on getting rid of their power. That classic thing of, you know, the science thing, the psychological thing of you should always give the most money to the one at the back of the queue, you know, and then the queue never forms, that sort of mm-hmm. thing. And it's, if you reward a politician by making sure that they're doing the job with as least power as they possibly can, that's probably the best way to be. I'm talking nonsense here, but yeah. I think power in humans is not a good thing, and that creates. I don't think we're very good with it.
I think that's maybe a simplistic way of looking at
Thank
the world.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's true though.
But that's
show
impossible.
Me someone power, I mean, and then show me what they're doing with it.
Everybody has power in certain spaces. Everybody has their own kind of power. I mean, you don't always have the same kind of power at work. But I mean, also, I know men right now who are saying that they, especially white men in positions of power, if you will, who are objectively like billionaires, essentially, who now say, I'm worried because I feel vulnerable when I talk to women. Because what if what I'm doing is perceived as harassment? And what if, you know, this comes out to the press? And so now they're worried. And then there's that sort of really, really toxic response, which is, well, now I don't even want to go to meetings with women. Which, of course, also I then think, well, welcome to like our world. I mean, you obviously should be cautious about what you say to other human beings. And women have always had to monitor whether what they're saying might be interpreted as sexual. That's just our world. And now it's just everyone's world, which probably always should have been. Like, think about what you say to other people and think about the impact it might have on them.
So how does your app work then, and how is it going to help?
Yeah, so Spot is a reporting tool. You go to talktospot.com.
And it's a two, number two, not a...
No, it's actually... So the website is talk2, like T-O,
oh, okay.
spot.com.
All right.
The Twitter handle is talk and then the number two,
okay.
Spot. So if you want both, you can find both quite
right,
easily.
Okay.
But you go to talktospot.com and you can click to chat with our anonymous bot. It takes you right. You can learn about what we do first if you want, and then you can click on it, and it's almost like WhatsApping with a robot, and it sends you messages, and then you write back messages, and the idea is that it asks you all the right questions to make sure that you've included everything that might be relevant about what's happened, that you reliably record it as soon as possible after something's happened, so you get what's called contemporaneous evidence, and that
what
then.
What does that mean?
It means that you've got evidence from the time.
Right.
So something happened today or yesterday or a week ago, and as soon as possible, you record it so that you have proof that that's what you remembered at the time in case you want to come forward, let's say a few months later when maybe things have gotten worse or now you're ready to come forward. And then we also allow anonymous reporting to your employer.
So I went through the process.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I did. Obviously, I did my research. it's good. It's so simple. And it does, it's funny actually, because it does, you do remind throughout the process that you're talking to a robot and not a human, because it does actually feel like you're talking to someone because it's actually having a conversation with you. It's very good actually. It's so easy to do.
It's supposed to be really natural and simple. It's supposed to make the whole process a lot more straightforward and easy.
Yes, it is. And you explain it in detail as well, so you don't get confused as to what's going on. Though you can send it to yourself to remember, or you can send it to your employers anonymously, or can you send it with your name on it?
I mean, you can be as anonymous as you want to be. And we at Spot don't keep any data because, I mean, that's a liability both for you and for us to keep sort of really sensitive information floating around. So we don't keep your conversation. You can tell us anything you want or don't want. You don't have to give us any email address if you don't want to. There's an option of just downloading stuff. So we have no idea who you are. And that's important to us because we think that it's, you need privacy. You need anonymity.
Just to be devil's advocate slightly and be on that, the guy who's paranoid, the boss you're talking, if one in 25 are psychopaths, isn't it a tool for them?
What about the liars? This is always the, what about the malicious reports?
The sociopaths, yeah. What happens
them?
With that?
What about them? They exist already. And right now there are already many mechanisms in place that would allow someone who hates you so much. I mean, first of all, I think for a company, that's still relevant information that people hate each other so much at your company that they want to take each other down.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably something you should fix or deal with. But let's say it's a malicious report.
Power again. That's what it is.
It is.
That's what it is. But humans aren't good with power. Carry on.
But I mean, there's so many barriers to reporting right now. I mean, if you report, there's a reason why 97% of people who are harassed or discriminated against at work never report it. Like the overwhelming majority of people who say, not just I'm not sure, but like I was harassed, say I never told anybody. So first of all, we know that people don't report because they're scared. They're always going to be called and their credibility will be questioned. They might get worse shifts at work. Worst case scenario, they think they might get fired. So they have to overcome all of these hurdles. And plus it's annoying. Like something happens to you that's a minute. Now you have to deal with it for weeks because you've reported it to HR. That's really annoying. Who has time for that, right? So, I mean, we're trying to remove some of those barriers. And in terms of malicious reports, those can still happen. I mean, our bot makes it a bit annoying to do that because it asks you lots of specific follow-up questions. But right now, there's ways to do that, and there will continue to be ways to do that. And it's up to your company to do an investigation and figure out which those are, if any.
In media, in my experience, we're pretty good at following up on this sort of stuff. How is it what sort of feedback are you getting?
We're getting very good feedback. So we're actually surprised also by the industries that are coming out. So we often think of, think of industries like tech, so Silicon Valley associated with things like sexual harassment. We think of Hollywood and we think of maybe banking or other sort of male-dominated fields. More recently, maybe university structures. But if we look at the statistics, actually the highest incidence of harassment happens in spaces like the service industry. So, and I'm not just talking about patrons, so like people who go to restaurants harassing waitresses. I'm also talking about waiters and waitresses amongst themselves. So it's the rates are really high. And so what we're seeing as well is that anything from like correction services, so like prison services, having harassment issues amongst their staff, to pharma industry, to a city council is in touch with us. I mean, we're having just this incredibly diverse response right now. And in terms of what we're building, we're actually building a tool for enterprise, which will help you tell essentially your people, we want to hear what you have to say. We want to hear about the little stuff before it escalates. And we want to value your voice, even if you feel like you have to stay anonymous. And so we're building a tool that people can manage incoming reports. They can also respond while keeping your anonymity intact by sending you a follow-up report. So it's really helping to streamline the process and encourage that conversation and normalize that conversation about what's happening at work.
I know you don't keep data, but can you keep stats?
We will be keeping stats on the reports that are submitted.
Right.
So we'll never, it'll always be free to use for individuals who've been harassed or discriminated against. The enterprise tool will cost money. We are a business, but we will never make money or analyze data that you're not sharing with us explicitly.
Which bit makes money?
The enterprise tool.
Oh, what's that bit?
So that's the management system for the back end. So we're working with companies right now who are helping us to test. So beta test our back end. And our backend being, it's something you can look at that your HR department can look at, especially if you're at a bigger company, and you can see all the reports that have come in. You make sure that the reports go to the right person and you can show what you've done. So what it ends up being is legal protection, both for the person who's submitting the report and for you, because you can prove here's all the steps we took to hear what's going on and to deal with it. Which is really, really important for your legal protection as well.
Right. So you'll be putting an app for an organization,
exactly.
Basically.
Yeah.
Okay. So just talk the science behind what you're trying to get out of the memory for people putting it down, because that's the important bit. That's why you're involved in it, isn't it? Because you know, if you wait 3 weeks, 2 weeks, the longer you wait, the worse your memory is of it. True?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, I mean, any memory, so as an expert who often sits in courtrooms and looks at cases and looks at also very, very extreme cases of crimes, so like child sexual abuse and stuff, like really, really intense stuff. The best case scenario, what you essentially always wish people have, is what's called contemporaneous evidence. So evidence from the time. Now that can be a note, that can be an email, that can be telling someone, that can be to some extent even a witness. But some sort of evidence that at that time you either told someone or wrote it down. Now, especially when we're talking about things that might become relevant later, so like a year later or 20 years later, I want to tell someone about this. If you have that evidence from the time, I pretty much go, well, as long as that was not, you weren't pressured into saying that, as long as the police interview was good, that's my job's done. Like, I can go home, because there's no room for social influence if you've already got the original version, and your memory can change as much as you want. You can access that original. Mm-hmm. And so with this, what I wanted to do is make sure that people who've experienced things can create that high quality evidence by being able to write something down right away, and by always having a bot that asks the right questions.
So I've been thinking about you a lot during the Me Too, the whole thing going
on. You think about me a lot. I'm thinking about you. It's very sweet, Tim.
It's your memory. I think about my memory a lot. And so when it first started coming through with the Harvey Weinstein stuff and the Bill Cosby prior to that, mm-hmm. you think, oh, wow, there's something in this, because there's so many people coming through mm. that you're going, okay. It's like U-Tree. Mm-hmm. When that happens, you get so many people come through, you go, okay, there's something here. I don't want to support any of these stars. I don't want to ruin the Me Too movement, but I keep thinking about you every time you get an individual case against a star. And there's been cases recently in America where their careers have been really hit hard mm. through one event which happened 10 years ago or something. Mm. I keep thinking, how can we trust that memory from that?
It's difficult.
What's your take on it all?
It's difficult. I mean, I have been involved. I was actually involved with the Rolf Harris allegations, or the second round of them. My report was not necessarily very helpful for the defense, because I essentially there are lots of witnesses and lots of other stuff.
So that's what you're looking for. Lots of witnesses means
witnesses. Yeah. Again, notes, all yeah. kinds. Like, if you go home and tell your parents right after something happens, I mean, that makes it less likely that it's massively changed. But even then, I mean, there is always some room, especially for historic allegations, that things have changed a bit, or maybe even changed substantially. And so again, that's why it's really important to me also to educate people on the fact that you think something important and emotional has happened to me, I will remember this because it's so important to me. Mm. But you won't. Like, you'll remember bits and fragments, and every time you tell someone, it has the potential to change. And so if it's really important that the details are accurate, you need to write it down. You need to put that somewhere where you can, again, have that good piece of evidence and say, look, this was the original version, not the version that came out months or years or decades later.
So when it's just one against one, mm-hmm. what can we do? Because it's powerful stuff at the moment, because victims are always believed at the moment, aren't they?
Absolutely not.
It is in the press.
Mm, but that's the ones who get there. So okay. In order to all get right. to the press, you're often yourself quite a high power person. Not always, but often.
You can just go onto social media or a journalist who wants to write up your story.
But nobody's going
to
do that, and nobody does that. Otherwise, we'd have way more stories. We have a lot of stories. But there are, I also have a partner who's an employment lawyer. And so he represents these people in court all the time. And it might be seen sometimes as that sort of anyone can come forward right now. I mean, you as a journalist, someone comes up to you, the first thing you said is, what's your evidence? Right? Yeah. Prove it. Just like anything else. Like, I can come up to you and say, I saw a UFO. Like, well, obviously prove it. I'm not just going to write about it because you say so. Yeah. Unless I'm a very uncredible fake news outlet, which there are, so that those exist, of course, but they can write whatever they want anyway, because they don't really care about the truth. It's more about, in terms of people coming forward, giving them a space and a conversation. So it's your word against mine. Let's say I say, Tim did something to me. Now the question becomes, for a company certainly, is, okay, well, let's look into this further. Let's start an investigation as to what happened. At the very least, I think my emotion should be addressed, in that the company should say, clearly this has, whatever, you're in a bad emotional state, whether something's happened or not, like almost at that point isn't the main issue. It's the biggest thing is, first, you're unhappy and this is going to affect your work. So we should talk about it and figure out a solution.
I wasn't going to talk about this, but I'm going to now. Okay. And I'm going to regret it. But I had a when all this stuff started coming through, it took me back to when I was a child, and I had a casting couch moment. A guy in a hotel room, don't know why I'm laughing, but it's quite tragic, wanting me to take my clothes off and everything. And
really?
Yeah. And
how old are you?
Oh, late teens, probably.
Oh, gross.
Well, yeah, I don't know, but I said no and I left the room. He promised me work and all that sort of stuff. It was quite a strange scenario to get myself in. But I'm saying this now, and I'm probably going to regret it, but I felt humiliated and embarrassed, especially the next day when some of the people are working. I'm like, what are you doing with that guy, sort of thing? And it was like, it's a bit embarrassing, really.
Did you tell them?
No.
No, of course not.
I would now, but I...
I was young then,
and I just sort of said, well, you know, we were talking about work. I didn't actually say that what had happened, but I left, and that's it. But it brought back the memory, and B, it also brought back the humiliation. Mm. I think it's funny now, if I'm honest with you, because I escaped it. Nothing horrible happened to me, and but it was just a bit of a weird situation. But the humiliation at the time made me want to... I sort of turned into anger a few days later as well. I was like, how did I get myself in that position? I was angry with myself more than...
See, but that's a huge problem, is that, and that's not no different now than it ever has been. Like, people blame themselves first, generally. So what did I do wrong? I mean, this is true for lots of kinds of crime. This isn't just true for harassment. This is sort of, you know, I'm embarrassed. I don't really want to tell anyone because this is really awkward. And what if they judge me for having...
I'm awkward telling you now. And it's,
well, no, but that's
quite a few years later.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. I mean, people now ask me all the time, like, well, you know, what have you experienced as sexual harassment or harassment? And I really dislike telling those stories, partly because they feel so personal. But B, why? I mean,
I don't want examples, but have you?
Yeah, of course.
All right, okay.
I mean, I feel like every woman who works has stories.
I'm looking at Fina. Have you got stories?
She's nodding her head. It's really
depressing. See, you're right about being a white male. I don't know about all this sort of stuff. So, yeah.
I mean, you know some of it, clearly.
Yeah, well, obviously.
And I'm not saying that white men don't know about this stuff. It's just, it's less likely to be as part of their reality as ours. But I think in terms of the stories, I mean, like that, like the embarrassment.
Hmm.
I've experienced a number of situations that I absolutely should have reported. Didn't even cross my mind that I would report them. I haven't even told people about them, never mind reported them to some sort of authority or HR. And I mean, this is, and that's me, never mind someone who's maybe even more vulnerable.
All right, how much is life and how much is someone pushing the boundaries? Like this, the guy who tried it on with me, you know, I should have.
Well, what could you possibly have done? You're a teenager. It's not your fault.
Yeah, I was still an adult, wasn't I? I was in my late teens. So I'm still an adult. And I just walked out and it was fine. And it was all
but it wasn't really, because you were still embarrassed. I mean, you're still humiliated and embarrassed. And didn't tell anyone about it. I mean, that's a consequence for you that asshole didn't have to have. That person just went on with his life and you had to have this stupid emotion.
Yeah, but
these
stupid memories now. It's a very stupid memory. But he was trying it on. How much of that is life and how much is I don't know how much of that is evil, as you say, and how much is just life. He thought, let's give this a go with this guy, and then he did get very angry with me, by the way, very angry.
Well, okay, so that's even worse.
I did think at the time.
What else did he do, Tim?
I did think at the time it was a strange scenario to be in, because it's like you don't. I didn't expect to be a sort of victim of a casting couch. I'm embarrassed telling you this. I wasn't even working in media at the time either. It's really bizarre.
The people who harass us are sometimes people we trust. I mean, that's also just like for sexual abuse, like if we go into more extreme cases, I mean, often it's people who have access to us and can put us into vulnerable situations that are then also take advantage of that. So it's not just sort of strangers. It's people who we trust. Yeah. But in terms of it really highlights the emotional complexity of these kinds of experiences. And I mean, if he got mad at you, like, imagine other teenagers on those couches, and maybe they weren't as strong as you, and maybe they didn't have those kinds of reactions.
He was offering the world.
Well, and in terms of whether it's normal, I think it's totally normal for people to try to have sex with each other. I don't think it's appropriate to say those things out loud at work.
Yeah.
Like, I think that there's a place for everything. Just like you don't get naked at work, you also don't sexual. Like, there's certain things you don't do and say at work that you can totally do at home, and that you can totally do at the pub, that you just... context.
This is your fundamental problem with the Christmas party, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've always thought, why do they just not do them?
Yes. Because I mean, just, literally.
It's just open season, isn't it, for all the harassy guys? And the
it is the single peak in the single biggest peak in harassment every year. Oh. Is that when you ask employment lawyers the amount of things that happen at Christmas
but
parties?
But when you add alcohol into the mix, then people are weird on alcohol, aren't they?
And people at that point also might struggle more to differentiate sort of time off versus work time.
Yeah.
And so they forget that it's a work event. And so again, like if you ask your colleague out for, I mean, obviously already be cautious about who you ask out for a drink, but let's say you ask someone and they respond positively and you consensually go and there's no power imbalance and you go out for a drink and then you, whatever, start a relationship, for example. I think that's totally fine because you've moved it out of the workspace into an appropriate space where that's totally fine. It's when you keep things in the workspace and you either don't think about or abuse your power dynamics, that's when we get into lots and lots of trouble.
The consensual thing is becoming quite a powerful word, isn't it?
What's not harassment if it's consensual? Like that's part of the definition.
Is it all right if I kiss you? Is it all right if I undo your blouse?
I think it's hot. I think consent is hot. I mean, if you go into kink communities, as soon as you start doing any kind of...
Can I video you to make sure you're consenting? I mean, that's apparently what's happening because they're going, I need the consent. It's like, wow, what have we come to?
I think in general, thinking about it and taking steps to ensure that the other person is interested the way that you are is a good thing and a healthy thing and definitely a sexy thing. And I think that, people can take, just like anything, people take anything to the extreme. But I think in principle, I think that's an absolutely the right move. And there hasn't been enough talk about it before.
Yeah, but it's worrying. It's one of those words which is sort of losing its meaning slightly, like the word bully.
Really.
It's a pretty specific legal definition, but it's being used. Like everything, I think one in 25 are psychopaths or something. Everyone will use everything as a weapon.
One in 100.
Psychologists say one in 100,
but psychologists say one in 100 when they have no idea how many people actually are. Like that's literally because they're rounding up from more than zero.
Is it?
Yeah. Like whenever you hear a psychologist say one in 100, it's like meaningless.
Yeah.
It's more than none, fewer than 1% probably.
But I think all these things, there's always going to be the rotten apple, isn't there? But we're moving in the right direction, which is the important thing. Let me ask you a question about we've talked about the victims of, say, Bill Cosby or Harvey Weinstein or someone like that. What about them? 20 years on, mm-hmm. say they only did stuff 20 years ago. Ralph Harris, mm-hmm. they only did stuff 20 years
a bit
on.
Different because totally different level of.
Of
crime, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but whatever happened 20 years later, did they start forgetting? Did they change their memory into, hey, I'm a really good guy, I never did that sort of stuff? Can that happen? Or
yeah, for sure that can happen. And again, I also think, I mean, Ralph Harris, again, aside, because that's a completely different situation, but in terms of talking about, some of it's a completely different situation, some of it's kind of similar, unfortunately. But if we're talking about more normal workplace harassment, that's not sexual assault. So that's sexual harassment rather than assault. So you're not physically touching people. You're not physically assaulting them. I think that, sure, your memories can change as someone who's done it. You might also not have thought at the time that this was perceived in that way. But I think it's, again, more... I'm now concerned about the call-out culture. Again,
What's the call-out culture?
So this idea that it's Weinstein's fault. And it is his fault to some extent. But it's not just his fault. Again, it's not... We're pretending that he's like this evil villain. And... He did do many inappropriate things, and I'm totally not on his side. But I think that we need to be careful not to pretend that, you know, this is a problem within Hollywood. This isn't Weinstein.
Yeah.
And this is becoming more and more clear as more and more allegations come forward and more actresses come forward about different people. But that's sort of the what about the perpetrators? Their memories can change. Yeah, they can reinterpret things. They also know the context of their own behavior. It's easier to justify your own stuff. It doesn't mean it's right, but they're right to some extent that there is context and we shouldn't forget that.
Okay, how do you know if you're being harassed? As I mentioned earlier, I felt embarrassed. Slightly humiliated and angry. I would never have thought of reporting it because in my mind, I'm big enough and ugly enough to take responsibility for everything. I didn't feel particularly harassed. I put myself in the situation. How do you know when you're being harassed?
You're being harassed when someone, so there are legal definitions for it, but in a very sort of broad sense, if someone says something inappropriate to you because of who you are, someone says something, you know, because you're a man and men are generally really stupid, I'm not going to give you this promotion, or I think that whatever, something about your gender, whether it's something about, you know, do you want to go for a drink with me because, you know, only then I'll give you the promotion, or I think you're really hot today. And it's your boss and you go, well, that was really inappropriate. Or if it's someone saying, again, back to the paternity or maternity example.
Again, Harriet Harman's book, she was her university professor or whatever offered her, if she wanted to get a better grade, had to sleep with him.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, I when I went to my first academic conference, I was literally given a list of people to avoid because the creepy old boys club, here are the list of people you shouldn't go talk to because they're going to try and sleep with you. Wow. And I'm 19 at this point, and this is just essentially known that avoid these people. I mean, unfortunately, it transcends industries. But
what about, I've got a really good example for you here, actually, because this is the sort of thing I'm trying to maybe get at. I'm on a WhatsApp group, and one of my friends is quite short, and everyone takes the mickey out of him, and I find it a bit offensive, because I think every time he goes away, he probably thinks, Christ, they're always taking the mickey out of me. So I said to them the other day, you really shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. There must be racism, must be shortism or something, you know. And I looked it up,
heightism.
Yeah. So John Bercow, is it the leader of the speaker in the house, that his name, I think it is John Bercow. He's actually done something on this because he's short, saying, come on, you can't keep on picking on me, I'm short. If you're the butt of a joke in an office, mm-hmm. that's harassment.
Oh yeah, for sure.
People who are doing it
are harassers,
but they don't think they are.
They might not.
They think that's
hilarious.
Yeah, they think that's common. That's fine. It's fine to do that because it doesn't affect me. I'm 5'11" or whatever, so I'm fine. He's 5'2". I can do it.
So if it creates a toxic workplace or it has an adverse consequence on you emotionally because of who you are, it's probably harassment. So again, it doesn't matter that the people think it's hilarious, and that, I mean, if you think about sort of 30 or 40 years ago, racist jokes that are completely inappropriate now were also like that, where it's like, oh, it's funny. Or, you know, women belong in the kitchen, those kinds of jokes, which are fading out slowly now, luckily. But I mean, if you said a lot of the things that would have been considered, quote, funny 30 years ago, obviously they would have been creating a toxic workplace for a person of color. Same thing now, and same thing in different industries and different for different people, is that if the emotional impact on you as someone who's experiencing or witnessing those jokes, for example, you're being harassed. And it's probably, if you want that to stop and if you want them to change what they're doing and maybe target other people, either tell them, maybe they don't know, or maybe pick it up with your HR department, or maybe you spot to report it if you don't feel comfortable.
Because the personal staying identified. It's only banter. The worst word ever invented at the moment.
Oh my God.
Banter. It's just banter.
I had a meeting with a bank that I will not name, but they have a new sexual harassment committee, and the person who made the invite for the calendar called it the Bants Committee.
Oh no.
And it was like, could you be more tone deaf? Are you kidding me? And it's sort of PC gone mad. It's like, no, it's respectful work environments where we don't want people to feel like we're singling them out and making a toxic workplace. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, so having worked in the sports industry for quite a long time on broadcasting and everything, and I think people are just catching up. I don't think they're bad people. That's the thing. I don't think people are bad people. I think they just need to be educated. The problem is we want everyone sacked. Rather than educated, we want them. That's what the culture we've created is. You've said something racist. You've said something sexist. Sack you.
I don't think that's true. I think actually
it is in some people, but
I think a lot of people don't report because they're worried about it being too much of a response. So I would definitely at this point feel uncomfortable reporting to some HR departments because I'm worried I'm like, well, okay, so Susan has said something inappropriate. I don't want her to get fired because of it.
Yeah.
I just want her to know, and I want to take up that conversation that we're not that kind of company.
Yeah.
And that's where we need right now we're very extreme with our response.
Mm.
We need to come down a bit and make it a much more normal conversation.
Yeah, because I think if you said to most people, actually that really upsets them,
and
they go home and they're really miserable, you go, oh, I won't do that anymore.
Yeah.
But your immediate thing is, because you're a human, you go, it can't be my fault. It's banter or something like that. That's your response,
bants
or whatever. Yeah. So we're going to run out of time here. I think the app I've been on it's easy to use in it, and I think it's an excellent tool.
Talktospot.com.
Yeah, talktospot.com. If you do feel like you're being harassed, go on there and do it, because I think it's an important thing. Make your workplace a happier environment for you. I was talking to an actor the other day on my show. I just want to quickly ask this to you because it intrigued me. Because I mentioned you on Sunday brunch, because he was talking about living method acting 6 weeks as a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, well, your memory's yours, or as the farmer, your character, basically. And he was like, oh, that's a really good point. I don't know. What do you think his memories would have been if he lived 6 weeks as somebody else?
I think that we definitely, I mean, they are memories. As soon as you're living as whatever you're living, even if it's quote method acting or you're sort of just enacting things, those are still memories of those things you did, even if they're not really your normal life.
Yeah.
And so they're forming real memories. And I think that even just visualizing stuff we know could get confused for stuff that actually happened. And yeah, I mean, I think that you can get confused as to sort of what's my normal life and what's sort of the life that I'm pretending to have, and ultimately potentially could change who you think you are. So I think there's a potential for there to be interference.
And just to, for anyone who didn't listen to it, you should go back and listen to the original podcast I did with Dr. Julia Shaw, because it's fantastic. But just to remind people, you can change your own memories, can't you, if you want to?
Yeah, and if you want to learn how to do that, you can read my book, The Memory Illusion.
It's a really good
book.
While
we're plugging things.
No, it is a good book. It is. That's why I read it. That's why I got you on, because I like it. And it's 60, 70 languages, so it must be good. Have you ever done anything with people with split personalities?
Arguably not a thing. Seriously, multiple personality disorder generally is considered probably not real. Hugely contested within medicine and psychology.
Really?
Yeah, probably something else. It's probably other issues, maybe schizophrenia, maybe issues with anxiety, etc. But like a real sort of the way we think of multiple personalities, A, incredibly rare, and B, probably not.
Has anything
an
else
accepted has phenomenon.
Since I last interviewed you, has anything else moved on in the world of memory? Is there anything else you've learned recently?
We've made some movement in terms of how we understand how memories are formed in the brain. But I think that's a bit too high level maybe for right now, for 30
for my
seconds.
My simplistic brain. Is that what you're saying? You tried to explain it last time and you lost me. I can't quite work out how
neural
it works.
Neural networks.
Look, we've got to ask you the questions. I might have asked you them last time, but I'm going to repeat them anyway. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Call grandma. Always call your grandma or your mom. Your mom misses you. Your grandma misses you. Tell the people you love that you love them. And if they tell you stories about their lives, I think write stuff down. So my grandma right now has dementia, and I wish that I'd written down all the family stories she had.
Yeah.
Because now they're disappearing and they're unreliable. So I think interview your parents about their lives.
Yeah.
So that you have your own family history down more.
That's a good idea. Yeah, I remember with my granddad, he just used to tell the same stories over and over again. I thought, oh God, I wish I'd asked, but you know, before he forgot everything apart from those few stories.
Well, and you think that, again, because you hear them growing up and you hear the same sort of family stories over and over again, that you'll remember them forever. But then you do lose the importance. I recently learned from my mom that my grandpa, who I never met, had apparently tried to kill himself and the whole family. Like, oh my God, the stories you hear when you start asking holy shit.
Yeah.
The stories you hear when you start interviewing your family about your own life and your own family. Oh my God. It's really interesting.
Why did he, was it a blood clot? Why did he do that?
jealousy, cheating, et cetera.
Oh, really?
Yeah. 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 It just snapped. Okay. Oh. I didn't go through with it, obviously, because otherwise I wouldn't be here.
The brains are fascinating, aren't they?
Yeah.
What your brain can make you want to do is.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. What mistake do people make? Maybe it's doing your job, but.
Not writing stuff down. So very basic. When something emotional happens, that's important for you to remember, whether it's your family, whether it's yourself, whether it's harassment or because of a crime, write stuff down. It's easy to forget. It's easy to overestimate your own abilities to remember.
I've become lazy recently, but I started writing a journal and it was really good, actually. Yeah. It's really nice just to get stuff down on the page. And when you do actually get stuff down the page, it, for some strange reason, leaves your head as well. So if you do have something traumatic and you write it down, it does weaken the trauma of it.
It can.
It seems to be doing it.
It can really clear your head.
Definitely. Yeah. Any life hacks?
Life hacks. Do yoga.
Do yoga.
Always do yoga.
Mindfulness. Clear your mind.
I really dislike it when they get into the spiritual stuff though, because then they lose me. But like the practice of yoga itself and being sort of, thinking, clearing your head, stretching, and the more intense stuff that happens.
I've been learning how to breathe properly recently.
There you go. See, related. I think if I didn't do yoga and breathing exercises, I'd be a completely different person.
Oh yeah, I really didn't know how to breathe until a couple of days ago. Mm. And it's just, I'm not just saying this. Amy, if you're listening, who taught me, it's just really changed how I feel about myself, because I think I was really shallow breathing, and now I've got this wonderful way that I breathe through the whole of my body. It's amazing. Yeah. I really believe in that sort of stuff. Any books you recommend apart from your own, which is brilliant, obviously, but what other books?
I recently read The Power by Naomi Alderman, which is a nice empathy exercise where women physically are able to dominate men. And essentially the power dynamic changes where women start being in charge of everything and start doing. And it's really interesting as well because it gets out of control. So women start doing all the things to men that men have been doing to women for forever. And it really also highlights how messed up some of the stuff is that men have historically and continue to do to women by switching it around. It's a really interesting sort of science fiction.
What's interesting about women is if anyone's going to clone themselves, it's going to be women, not men. You know, they're finding more animals, female animals can clone themselves.
We sort of already can. I mean, compared to you, we are able
we're
to make
rubbish.
More humans.
We don't have anything.
I'm not totally self-sufficient, but we're much more self-sufficient than you are in that regard.
Oh, I feel terrible.
Right. Anyway.
Okay. One of the final questions is, what is the meaning of life? Which is really poignant with you because that's what we discussed last time you were on the podcast. What is the meaning of life?
42, right, or something. I think the meaning of life for me certainly is to try and I don't know the answer to that. What's your meaning of life? That's a big question.
I'm not answering that yet. I keep asking all the guests who come on, they have different versions of it. I suppose it's to live.
That's boring. But what does that mean?
Well, find stuff that makes you feel alive. Like the other day, it was snowing, and I was at a pool, and I went out in my. I think I'm a nutter now. I went out in my swimming trunks in the snow and just laid there watching the snow fall on me, and I just felt alive.
As
I think that's
you, as
the,
you do.
That's
the, yeah.
And I thought that, but I had discussed cold showers on this. Cold showers are good. They make you feel alive. Hurts, but it makes you feel alive. Do it.
I went to Norway at one point and did a sauna and then jumped in a freezing river. And I'm like, why am I doing this?
It's good for you.
But it is really exciting.
Makes
because
you
your
feel
adrenaline
alive.
Going. I think finding your passion and trying to live your passion projects as much as you possibly can.
Yeah, find a purpose and also do nothing and live. Because I think we spend too much time running around trying to live human version of what we're supposed to be doing rather than living your version of it.
Yeah, and back to the breathing exercise and the yoga, right?
Yeah.
Being in the moment.
It's true. Get yourself into nature. Is there an afterlife?
No. I mean, there is, if you think about it conceptually, in terms of... So I like to think that by birthing a book... that my ideas can continue to live in the minds of others because they can read what I've written.
Why miss your memory when you die?
Well, again, your memory becomes other people's memories of you. So that's the closest thing you get to your memory, I think.
See, memories are so weird because I said this to you in the last podcast, no part of my body is apparently more than 9 years old. And yet I can remember things from past that. So it's a bit like triggers... broom in Only Fools and Horses. You won't get that, will
nope.
you? No.
Nope.
Okay.
no idea.
Trigger had the same broom for 13 years or something, and it's had 9 handles and 10 new heads. So basically, it's a completely different broom, it was funny on Only Fools and Horses. Neither of you two are laughing, but
it's always good to, when you have to explain a joke. That's always the key. So the key to good humor.
There's nothing in my body or anything that's over 9 years old. Yeah, I've got memories past 9 years. So how is it all staying in there? What is there anything in me? What's passing that memory on?
I don't.
Too long.
Really conceptual, but on a very basic level, I think there is an afterlife only in the sense that we can live on in the minds of others, and I think that's beautiful. But I don't think there's an afterlife otherwise.
You've used simplistic with me and basic level. That's basically where you see me at.
Not in so many words.
Okay. Where can people follow you if they want to question your stuff?
If they want to harass me online, they can go find me on Twitter at Dr. Julia Shaw. They can send me a message through the Talk to Spot website, or they can find my website, drjuliashaw.com.
And if you want to report harassment, you just log on to booktospot.com.
Yeah.
And it just takes you through. I've done it. It's really easy. Mm. So, yeah, if you are going through that, give it a go. And it's good because you can just send it anonymously. So, mm-hmm. you know, you can make your impact without making yourself enemies at work, really.
Yeah, and if you want to just sit on something, you can keep the document for yourself. And then when you're ready to disclose, you can send it in or give it to someone later.
Yeah, and there has been a time in my life that I wish I'd done that, and that's serious. And it wasn't obviously sexual or anything, but it was a harassment of a sort at
it's
work.
Pretty sexual. It was pretty directly
sexual.
No,
that's another thing. Oh. I've had something else which I wish I
now
had.
Now they're
done.
All coming up.
Yeah, because you're bringing all these memories up. Yeah, this last
see?
Time you're coming
harassment
on the
podcast. Can happen to anyone.
Yeah, so do that. And your new book, Evil, The Science Behind Humanity's Dark Side, is out next year, is it?
It's out in January 2019.
Okay.
So you can pre-order it, I think, if you want to go to Amazon and pre-order my fantastic new book.
You'll definitely come back on for that one, won't you?
I would love to.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll see you soon.
Great. Cheers. See you soon, Tim.
So that was Dr. Julia Shaw. Did you enjoy that, Fina?
I can't remember it.
I think she's great. I think that she's taught me so much about the memory. And I do think hopefully we're moving in the right direction with this. I think her app, I mean, I went on it. It's quite easy to use. I think it's going to be a good tool.
It's such a simple concept. I never thought about that myself. Just taking note of things that even you think you feel mildly uncomfortable about.
Yeah.
Just note it down. It's useful because you will forget things. It's just, yeah. Really simple concept.
It's how the memory works, isn't it? And we do. Did you find some of that stuff interesting?
Yeah.
Did you find the fact that she called me both simplistic and basic?
I like that bit. And I've learned to never go.
I'm reporting her. I'm reporting Dr. Juliet Shaw. For just right. I can't wait till we start filming these one day, because some of the time she just looks like, I can't explain this to you, Tim, because you're not going to understand it. I do like her. She's great. I can't wait for her book to come out about evil. That's going to be good.
Definitely get
on for that. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. Let us know what you think. You can contact me at Tim Lovejoy or email dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. You can subscribe to us, rate us 5 stars. We will see you all soon. And until then, peace and love, Joy.
Bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.